Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is brought to you by the new term at FXPhD.com. Among the new courses this term, our new Katana Lighting Training, a world first with Matt Leonard. Included in that is free VPN access to a full version of Katana, along with many other key programs to help you learn, such as Arnold, Maya, Nuke, Cinema 4D, and many more. They're all there to help you take your career to the next level. Check it all out at fxphd.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. Be sure to check out all of our podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Our guest today is Bill Westenhofer, visual effects supervisor for Life of Pi at Rhythm and Hues. The film is nominated for the Visual Effects Oscar. Life of Pi recently also received 3 awards at the VES Awards, as well as winning the British Academy Film Award, the BAFTA, for special visual effects. In his BAFTA acceptance speech, Bill wrapped up with this: "Last but not least, I want to say for those of you who do visual effects, you all laud us for our science at times, but we're also artists, and we thank Life of Pi for the opportunity to show that if you give us the opportunity, we will make art with you. So thank you very much." From my view, this has been the theme this entire awards season. Ang Lee made similar comments in his speech at the VES Awards, accepting the VES Visionary Award, saying, "To me, there is no visual effects. It's all part of filmmaking. It all intertwines. They are the expression of our heart." Ang Lee had great comments about coming into visual effects on Hulk and being totally overwhelmed by the process. You can read more of his remarks on the story about the VES Awards at FX Guide, as well as the transcript from the BAFTA team. I should point out that this interview was done before any of the Rhythm and Hues financial problems were announced, so that topic will not be part of this interview. Before we get to that interview, here's a bit of Bill's bio. Before leading R&H's team on Life of Pi, he served as visual effects supervisor on The A-Team, Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Lightning Thief, and Land of the Lost. In 2008, Bill received the Visual Effect Oscar for overseeing the work of R&H artists on The Golden Compass. He was previously Oscar-nominated for The Chronicles of Narnia, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, and his other supervisory credits include Elf, The Rundown, Men in Black 2, Cats and Dogs, Stuart Little 1 and 2, Frequency, and Babe, Pig in the City. Let's get started now. Mike Seymour speaks with Bill Westenhofer.
I was in love with the film, and I thought it was really amazing, but in judging the visual effects, there's a point at which this film, by nature of the story, moves away from reality. Obviously, by the time mm-hmm. you're at the island, there aren't many teeth that appear in kind of flowers. But obviously, to get me there, you had to be so grounded in realism at the start of the film, and a lot will be discussed, obviously, in the show about, and in this interview, I'd like to talk a lot about the character animation work. But right out of the gate, the opening title sequence just had me stunned for the beauty and the way the animals were looking. So you had a lot of realism building up. But was there a sense of, well, as you've got the audience on the life raft, you can start to get a little further away from reality? Or, I mean, what was that kind of benchmark?
Absolutely. We did, Ang does a ton of reference and a ton of study because he wanted, for that very thing, he wanted, when we were going to put the water, we had to know exactly what water looks like, to the point of he took a bunch of us out on a Coast Guard cutter off the coast of Taiwan in heavy seas so that we could all experience it, get video reference of it, know what we were creating. All of our skies are grounded in photography. They're super high-res HDR images so that we do start with the real thing. And then we do push it. It is a whether or not, I mean, it's never explicitly told yay or nay, but this is Pi recounting a tale. So maybe there weren't 10,000 flying fish. Maybe there were 100, but in his mind, that's how many you see. And then little by little, you know, the same kind of thing. The choice. Ang did say he told us from the outset that we got back from from a long shoot in Taiwan. He sat with the crew and he talked about all the technical challenges ahead, but he finished with, talking that he wanted to make this an artistic film. So we, all along, the choices were made. We want to make this real. We want to make sure that the audience is you know, is believing what they're seeing, but we want it to be beautiful. And that would trump reality if the choice had to be made. A great example early on is the scene where he wakes up and the water is now completely mirror smooth and reflecting the golden sky. Photographically, you're never going to get a golden sky that wraps 180 degrees around. You may get, you know, you can photograph stuff at the sun and in the vicinity of the sun with a telephoto lens, you may get an all yellow image, but for the most part, it's yellow wrapping into blue. But we pushed that and we let that be. He wanted, his description to me was that he wanted this to be liquid gold. It's Pi talking to God, and he wanted to feel, have that beautiful sense. But and even the water too, we wanted to be completely still. Interestingly enough, though, as much as people say, you know, that's where we start to depart from reality. There have been sailors who came up to Aang after the film and thanked him because the ocean does get that smooth at times, and it's something that no one would believe it unless they saw it. But there is some reality in any of the artistic choices that we made.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because at the point in the film, and I'm one of those people that hadn't read the book, so at that point in the film, one assumes everything is real, and even though it's being recounted from an adult's perspective, remembering back, which gives you a certain amount of flexibility, by the end of the story, you've actually got much more of a narrative-based excuse for deviating from reality, I guess is probably the best way to describe it.
Right. I mean, certainly by the time we get to the island, and the whole guts of the novel is that while it's certainly up to the reader to decide what parts are real or whether Pi was making this up, and if he's making it up, what's his motivation, or whether he's really recounting something that he truly saw. It's up to the audience to decide that, and in the novel, it's the island comes. It's the point where, you know, everyone starts to break down and start to ask that question. You know, if you hadn't had that point, if things stayed completely acceptable up to that point, you may never get to that moment where you have to challenge your faith and say, do I believe this or do I not? And the island's really a test of that moment.
So for as artistically valid and as great a piece of art as I think it is, I'm going to, if I could, beg your indulgence to focus on the technical side of things for a bit, because I do think that the film is technically excellent and nearly flawless. And so I do want to discuss some of the technology behind it and pay homage to Rhythm and Hughes, because the company has a reputation, someone would say, for talking animals. But the point about this is these animals don't talk, they emote, and they provide a tremendous emotional thread for the film, which is a pretty remarkable feat. Can I ask you, though, you have a master's degree, don't you, from Washington University in the dynamics of physics-based animation? So was that physics-based animation at a creature level or in Sims for sort of destructions?
That was back then. I was always interested in dynamics and how, you know, when you're doing animation, animators tend to think, you know, pose to pose, and you can think in the broad body terms, but there's dynamics and there's little vibrations that happen that make things look like they're real. It's often, for example, with motion capture, raw motion capture will feel weightless because you're missing some of the jiggles and the dynamics of things that are attached and other things that just the shake of the muscle really is as important as selling the weight as the motion of the limbs. So that was an attempt of trying. I had a articulated figure that had spring forces to give it some dynamics control, and then you manipulate it by taking a clone of that and just keyframing it and then letting that impart forces onto the object. Something I've talked to software people here about implementing several times. It hasn't really gone through, but it's always in the back of my mind of, you know, could we have an animator animate keyframe and then let the computer do what it always does and add the fine detail and make that real, analogous to lighting, where, you know, there's a point where you can artistically place lights and try to get something to look real, but you have to get the rest of the way there. You need to let the computer do global illumination and get those tiny nuances that are hard to art direct, but without them, you're missing that the photorealism.
So I'm really keen to discuss this, and if we can just sort of obviously we'd be you know, we have the perfect vehicle upon which to do that. Richard Parker, most people would realize you had great reference, but I think the problem I've got is that in some of the interviews you've done, there's a quick sort of jump that goes from, oh, we had really great reference, and so we had really great lighting, so the animators matched the reference and they lit it and it worked really well. And I'm kind of like, wait a second. Let's back that up for a second. So with all the best reference in the world for posing and for what a creature might do, what's selling this is a series of things. And even if we got to see a making of video, we'd see a skeleton and we'd assume that there'd be you know, a bone structure that would lead to eventual skinning and then some fur, but that process is really, I think, where the realism, the first major dose of realism is coming into your work, because obviously we expect there to be some sort of kinematics that's leading to a mechanism that's working, but the way that the skin works on these animals is obviously not sort of attached quite the way human skin does to a
right.
to a muscle. Can you talk about that, because it's really quite subtle?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I had the distinct pleasure of actually touching a tiger, and I felt a tiger. You can describe a tiger as this solid mass of muscle. I mean, it's really when you put your hand on his back, it's like touching a rock. But surrounded by that is this really loose skin, and so there's this baggy shaking, and the way it kind of folds when he sits down. It's a really complicated thing, and we had to solve that with a two-pass skin solve. The first one would, you know, we did the animation, and we had our muscle controls that would cause the skin to, or cause the muscles to knot up, and then we put a layer of skin that stuck to the surface, you know, that was shrink wrapped around and would slide over the muscles and you know, be tugged around as if, you know, the same way of you know, someone with a bodybuilder with skin over his muscles would do. And then from that, we suspended a cloth solve. You know, this thing, it would be pulled around by that lower skin, but then it would have drapery and would wrinkle up, especially around his waist and around his arms, and it would, you know, have some extra shake and sway as he bounced around the boat. But that, it was really a complex thing, and to try to have that was the only way we could get this to feel the connection, you know, the loose and elastic connection of the skin to the muscles and bulge by them, but also have the drapery that was necessary.
So if we have the animal leaping, just let's say it's on one side of the life raft, leaps to the bottom, leaps up to the other side. So I presume that somebody is sort of keyframe animating that leap. Is there then from that the muscle stuff being solved by what? I mean, like, that's an automated process, right, to get the muscle contraction and or not?
It is. There's an automatic system. We do have a team of tech animators who it has to be managed. You know, you do in the rig, you code the muscles and you have you get them to respond. But there's also muscle if. An automatic rig just looks at the angles between different muscles, between different limbs, to decide whether the muscles fire. But really, the way it works is the muscle fires first, and that starts the movement of the limb. So you need to, somebody needs to go in and make sure that they fire ahead of time. You know, and muscles will fire when he's taking weight, for example, as opposed to necessarily a limb movement. So there's an artistic level that has to be applied on top of that, and decisions have to be made from an animation sense for the muscles that require an artist to go in and add a touch.
And as somebody was pointing out to me that even though when the muscle is flexing, it doesn't look this way, it's completely volume preserving.
Correct.
Right.
And you know, you just imagine you can put your hand on the desk without even moving your arm. If you contract your muscles, it causes a shape change. So that you have to know, you have to make an animation decision that there's tension going on and you need to fire those muscles, even though the limbs hasn't moved.
Right, so it isn't as simple as the sort of IKs just causing muscle deformations, right?
Right.
And then
right.
And now I've got those muscle deformations happening, and I'm going to leave aside the facial stuff for a second, even though you didn't do much anthropomorphization. So now I've got this presumably some level of fat, or is it just such a lean animal that didn't be something you'd have to worry about?
There's, I think it's less fat, and as opposed to you have, where, especially the belly area, when the abdominal muscles aren't contracted, it does, the muscles themselves have a jelly-like behavior. So like there's, you have to let the muscles themselves have some loose dynamics that, you know, whether it's a fat layer or whether it's muscle, it's still going to give you a similar behavior. And that will drive the motion of the skin as well. Even that we had, you could spend years and years and years tuning the model so that it works well in every position. And really what you end up doing is we go through some calisthenics and we set the rig and then we run it in the shot. And sometimes it just bounces too much and someone has to go in and dial it down. And that's a shot by shot type of adjustment.
And because Richard Parker was sort of not, you know, perfectly landing every time, he'd sometimes sort of fall and the mm-hmm. boat was rocking. There seemed to be some level of sort of collision sims, contact sims stuff going on mm-hmm. in terms of inertia and self-collision. Was that what I was seeing? Was that just well animated on top?
All the time. And that was a conscious choice. Eric DeBoer, our animation director, gave him a ton of credit that it's such a confined space and we took every opportunity to have the tiger's tail smash into the side or have him, slide and compress against things, and that would be fed back to the tech animators to not only affect the skin and the muscles, but also the fur. The fur would collide against that and have to be deformed away. But we wanted to, and it was something we saw with the real tiger that they're in a confined space. They're going to back up and crouch against the side, and we wanted to use that to really show that he's genuinely there, and affected by the environment.
You mentioned the fur there, and I think that's another great aspect before we even get to lighting, just in terms of the animal fur. I guess if I could refer to the Lion from Narnia, which was a really great effort in this area that Rhythm and Hughes did, the hair on the animal is kind of stiff, right? It's not quite the same as human hair, but more importantly, it clumps. Right. And it's that clumping that stops it looking like it's kind of frizzy. I guess even more so when it's wet, when we get clumping and matting. But before we get to the wet stuff, because that is its own thing, I mean, are you still using the same mass spring approach that you used from Narnia about 5 or 6 years ago, or has that changed?
It has been. It's been adapted. It's still, I would say, on this film, there's nothing, everything has a tie back to what we're using in Narnia. They've been developed. Maybe the guts of the controls are a little different, but they're still the same idea. There's spring mass. There's a level of collision detection that's proximity based. That you have to try to maintain some distance with the guide hairs. You can put some magnet deform controls in the software. So it's all relatively similar, but we've done improvements so it's faster and so it's more manageable by an artist. I mean, those would be the types of changes that have occurred.
And even back on Narnia, you had wind dynamics happening on those those guide hairs, but also I think you had a pelt wind tool that allowed you to add dynamics on top of that.
Right.
So clearly, these guys were at sea, so there's wind. So I guess that also played, even though the hair is shorter than on the lion.
Right. Yeah. So we didn't have the same. There would be more case for pelt wind and less of the real flowy stuff going through. There's a small mane, a beard around the tiger that would be affected, but it's not the flowing stuff that you saw on the mountaintop of on the lion.
Which gets us now to the lighting, and again, I don't want to sound critical of my peers that have written about this, but there's, you did an HDR and that sort of solved the lighting. And I'm like, wait a second, what HDR? I can't imagine any HDR that would work.
No, in fact, so from a lighting standpoint, two things. We were able to ray trace the hairs completely. Computers have gotten fast enough that we were able to do that now. And we took advantage of that by... The lifeboat would be, we would either, and actually I can go back to the tiger. There's quite often in the movie where we end up replacing the lifeboat as well, just for interaction and for lighting purposes. But where for lighting the tiger, we would either use the digital lifeboat or we would project the photography onto the tracked boat, and that would light the tiger. Combining that with that was always a complicated discussion. Do we use the HDRIs from the sky to light the tiger, or do we use the HDRIs from the set? We actually did use a set HDRI only because the you know, the Tiger had to link in with the lighting of Pi on the boat. And we would take care to make sure that the skies, the lights positions would complement the two. Otherwise, the whole thing would fall apart anyway. But it would be a set HDRI that would take care of the lighting from, you know, that basically would pick up whatever lights that Claudio had put in the scene so that the Tiger was lit the same way as the boat would. But then the bounce light and everything from the boat would come from ray tracing the hairs and collide and bouncing those off the boat itself.
So that almost sounds like a two-stage solution, right? Because if you can light the character to look like the actor, and then both of them could be color graded to match the sky, but whatever you're having to do to the actor doesn't get to inherit an HDR of the sky, right?
Exactly. So you know, we had to make the two mesh there, and then the other. Another big component of the lighting, we did true fur subsurface. So that's, you know, same way with skin. With white fur, it's critical that you have light bouncing in, getting color shifted and emerging out in the shadow side. Otherwise, you have this really gray, fake-looking thing.
Yeah. Now, I think it was your renderer. What were you actually rendering this in?
That was in Ren. So yeah. the Tiger... All the animal work was rendered in Rhythm and Hughes's proprietary render. The water is rendered in Mantra, so that had some complications whenever the Tiger decided to take a dip. That we had to figure out how to deal with the two.
Well, we have to talk about that because I was going to say this would literally. I was about to say if this had all been a lifeboat sitting on the back of a truck, it would have been an excellent exercise. But the fact that you had to add the Tiger in the water, that shot from the side when the Tiger is kind of on the edge of the, it's sort of almost resting, having tried to get back into the lifeboat before he brings it back in. I mean, I remember my mouth was just open in the theater, just staring at this going, oh my God. So whose sim is driving who? Because there's water sims, cloth sims,
That's where, you know, my hat's off to Jason Baver, our digital supervisor. That was a management exercise. He has a flow chart that shows what happens when we introduce fur with water. And it's this back and forth chain. It would start with the water sim guys would simulate a surface. They would hand that to the animators. The animators would animate the Tiger so his head's above water and performing. Then we would take that animation, give it back to the sim guys, and have the water collide with the Tiger all the time, looking at it to make sure, you know, now that the sim's doing its thing, make sure we haven't drowned the guy, and so that his head still is above water, and maybe make adjustments and feedback again. Once we're happy with that, we get flow fields from the water simulation to drive the hair dynamics and get the hair to flow appropriately underwater. The hair, you know, that would generate wet maps to know when the tiger comes up out of the water. There's a brief moment where he's almost clear coated and he's covered by this sheet of water, but that quickly sieves down into the hairs and it ends up, you know, feeling like it's drying out really quickly. So we had to go have maps that were generated from the water that drive that. The hairs, you know, they would mat up and clump, and then, you know, we'd have a water simulation of drips that come off that and feed back into the water sim. It's just this round and round thing. And then to light it, we mentioned we have two software packages. We would have we're able to project like a fur, rendered fur onto the Tiger to use as a refraction object that lit through the water in Mantra, and then gave deep compositing maps to allow the compositor to blend the Ren sections with the Mantra sections and back and forth. But it was a very complicated, convoluted thing to it just to get that to work.
Can I pick up on that last part, the deep compositing that you referred to? Do you mean deep compositing in that sense that you actually didn't have to have holdout mats between the CG?
Right.
So that is a very interesting pipeline, isn't it? I mean, it's data heavy, but it does give your compositors a lot of flexibility.
It gives you a lot of control and help, and you know, it helps with you know, this is also being done in stereo, and it's with, you know, any. We call them stereo events or stereo moments, where, you know, something, for whatever reason, something didn't mat right, and you had a layer, and it would tweak your eye, and something, you know, something's wrong, but you could massage that with the maps that way, and get something, you know, bring something back over and alleviate the problem.
And the final compositing was done in Nuke?
No, it was done in ICEE. That's okay. our Rhythm and Hues package. We have for dealing with stereo, we gained a lot of tool sets and expertise and Yogi actually. We do a lot of pre-processing work. When we first get the stereo plates, we run this process that literally compares each pixel to the other and creates a disparity map. It's really interesting to watch too, because you could see when the mirror flexed at the end of a big camera move, and you know all those little it pick up those subtle details and back those out so that we had a pristine stereo image to work with, which was critical for tracking and getting things to line up quite often.
Just a note on that: did you just make one eye God and then adjust the other one to it, or did you?
That's how we usually fix it. And that was up to the QC team of which one was better. Color, we try to use the through lens for color matching as well. But the disparity map could also be used once you've identified where another pixel lies. We could get a pretty exact color match between the two, so that that fixed the color issues.
Surely one of the biggest issue had to be polarization of the mirror, because I mean this is the killer for spec highlights. Right.
We actually got a quarter wave retarder was put on that solved quite a bit of the polarization issues on water. That was something that we were worried about going in of, and it really there was some left, but it got rid of the vast majority. It wasn't a huge issue for us most of the time. You'd see it more in highlights and other things, but for the most part, the water reflection was not a problem.
So the last thing I think we need to give credit to in terms of the realism is that in that compositing stage, or perhaps it was in the grading stage, there was a really nice matching, because even when all is said and done, there is still an art to grading something to looking like it's sitting in, mm-hmm. even if it's mathematically mm-hmm. correct. How was that mm-hmm. final grade to make it really sit into the shot? Was that done at the composite level, or did you pass mats through to some DI process?
A little of both. We did. We tried to give. We tried to get things to sit in at Rhythm and Hues as much as we possibly could. I did participate in the DI at Technicolor with Dave Cole, the colorist, and we made some further adjustments there. A lot of that was by design. We didn't bake in. We backed off on the contrast a little bit just to make sure that there was room to adjust things in the DI. So we gave a little more punch in places and did some a little more balancing between shots and things like that. But for the most part, we tried to get things look really solid here before we send it out to the DI. And because we were making we were trying to design these artistically. We tried to set the color and get it in a pretty good place here, so that we knew what we were doing with it and we didn't have any surprises once we got there.
Right, and then an overall grade presumably was being applied. Was there any places that in the overall grade, hence you've got unity in effect to match your mm-hmm. your environment? But did you then see any overall grades that just came through as a late creative process where the director just decided to go, or the DOP, in kind of a slightly different way with everything?
They did take. There were some oceans that we had put from the reference that we'd taken. We had put some variety in colors and some. There was a morning scene that was a little warmer that they kind of cool off and made more consistent. And we worked really hard to make sure that we had as tight a black match and white match so that they could they had a lot of latitude. So they did push some things in a different direction and it stayed together. But it's really critical, with the prevalence of DI, I think it's really important to make sure that visual effects is part of that process, because you can break composites if you're not careful, and having someone there to QC the process and make sure that it's done done safely is really important. And it also, there's times when I would sit there and see something that as you're watching the whole film, it's like, oh yeah, I really wish you can go nudge that little thing, and we still had time to make little contrast adjustments or little color corrections of something that it just was good to be part of that DI process.
Well, now, if I can just shift gears completely, Life of Pi is clearly nominated as one of the five films for this year's Academy Award, and I don't want to focus in any way, shape or form on who should or could win, but I do want to focus on the other nominees if I could, because I think that your opinion in terms of digital character work is one that I'd love to hear, and it's obvious to anyone looking at the list that Avengers, Prometheus, Huntsman and Hobbit all have very strong digital characters, though I think it's probably safe to say you have the most realistic characters, albeit them non-human.
Well, thank you.
What's your assessment? What's your assessment of the work that's being done in some of those other films? And maybe we should start with some of the character work. So I guess Avengers and Prometheus probably, and we can guess, because obviously Rhythm and Hughes, for those that don't know, obviously. I say obviously. For those that don't know, Rhythm and Hughes did the troll in Huntsman, and that was one of the great standout scenes in that film. But if we could just talk about Avengers and Prometheus, the engineers and Hulk, that seems to be a really good example of being able to integrate characters into live action and have very good control over subsurface. What's your take on those characters?
Absolutely. I was blown away. I mean, it's a really, really impressive year. The Hulk was fantastic to watch. You know, they really did a great job of dealing with something that's got such mass and still, you know, moving in a believable way to the weight. And you know, Avengers was such a fun film. The comedic aspect, you know, in a digital character is great to see. You know, where he does the little snap fist thing to knock him out of frame was
inspired.
The audience just loves it.
You just don't care about the physics at that point. It's just
exactly. Yeah. It's fantastic. And the Gollum was stunning. You know, it really the motion capture of and just it's always the mouths and eyes tend to be the hardest thing when you've got a human-like character, and they really, really nailed that stuff. And it was you just sit down and you enjoy the performance and the weirdness and great weirdness of Gollum as a character.
I got to talk to Joe Letteri about Gollum, and it was very interesting hearing, you know, because they obviously got to revisit a character, which one doesn't get to do very often with the whole letter generation technology. But just in talking to other people around the Gollum, it became apparent to me that they do an enormous amount of work on the caustics on the eye, the way light, you know, basically plays. And I was wondering, like, you must face similar issues, right? Like getting the eyes to have soul.
Absolutely.
Is what's driving these characters.
It's all the and with with the tiger, same, you know, we ray trace the eyes, we get caustics, and we give a lot of controls to the artist to make adjustments, and keeping them alive. It was with the tiger, they tend not to rotate in their sockets that much, but if you made it's one of the things, if you made a statement to the animator and say they tend to just move their head and do that, it's not just, they aren't fixed, there's these tiny little adjustments, and you want to you need to get those kind of things right. And it's what was great, just going back to reference again, what was really important is that the just telling someone I need more jiggle or I need more mass isn't really going to win the day, because it tends to be it's more complicated than that of how a ripple happens from the claw all the way up the arm. And if you get it right, it looks completely real. If you get it wrong, it looks like some sort of animation render error. So you got to get those kind of things finessed. But really, eyes are very important, and keeping that movement, keeping it alive, is critical, or else the thing looks like it's dead.
Talk to me about weight for a second. You mentioned it in Hulk, but also the troll had tremendous weight, and it's obviously a lot more than just putting camera shake every time they step. What is it, you think, because and it's ironic, I guess, because Ang Lee already took a shot at Hulk, but that universally, I think animators would say that Hulk managed to hold that sense of weight even though he was leaping around without looking weightless. But the troll had good weight as well. What's sort of driving that, do you think?
It's a funny thing. With anime, your animation occurs, and when getting things to start and stop with a certain speed and acceleration is important, but a lot of it is the secondary stuff, and that's where secondary, like when something lands, what the muscles do at the moment of impact is as important as selling something as weight as the globe, the gross animation and the, you know, the in and out and the timings of actions. I think very careful attention to that is was put in the Troll and obviously put into the Hulk, and those are the things that are critical to selling weight in a scene.
I think the engineers and Gollum both shared a sort of a near translucency to the skin, which I thought was interesting. Obviously, character driven in both mm-hmm. cases, but that that really your toolbox, I guess, with this much more physically plausible lighting and shading type of stuff. Really, you said you did some sort of scattering on the fur, but mm-hmm. I mean mm-hmm. that has it's not just. Subsurface scattering on or off. There have been some significant advances in subsurface scattering over the last decade, and it's definitely, right. Like for example, one of the things I thought was interesting is the way that the subsurface is being dealt at high contrast edges, you know, around a lip, for example. Mm-hmm. I presume your algorithms have advanced as well. You must be appreciating that advance in subsurface scattering.
Absolutely, and just the consideration of the materials through the surface, that it's the first passes of subsurface tended to treat it as a homogeneous material. You know, they simulated marble and that, but really you have different responses of different layers of the dermis, and when you hit muscle, you get a different response. And trying to model that is all these tiny things are. We're getting to the point where to describe it verbally or to tell an artist and sit down and art direct it is becoming very, very, harder and harder. But you look at something and it's not quite real and you're not sure what it is, and it is literally down to coding the simulation right and letting the computer calculate what's meant to be there to let it recreate reality in as much as you can that's generating the realism that you're seeing today.
So you're an Oscar-winning VFX supervisor. You've done enormously photoreal digital characters. If a script came to you now to do a human, like a non-fantasy-based actual actor, do you think you can cross the uncanny divide, or do you think we're still a fraction short of being able to deliver a completely believable, synthetic, normal actor? Of course, there's a whole ethical issue as why you'd want to, but leaving that aside for a second.
Right. I think we're right there. There's some things that I've seen that we've been working on that'll come out later this year that are pretty impressive. I think with these advances, it is the uncanny valley. It's coming down to more and more minute things, and it's with advances in motion capture and advances in the detail that I think we're right. We're just about there.
So if you had to rate them in terms of the area that needed to just get that last push, is it sort of the technical lighting, subsurface scattering material stuff? Is it the rigging for realistic kind of face movement? Or is it just the modeling in terms of getting... Because all three of those are kind of slightly different technical challenges.
I think rigging tends to be a little more important to me. The areas that most often fail, like I mentioned, are the areas around the mouth and the lips and the eyes. That when they aren't rigged right, they really, it's the biggest separator of the uncanny valley from things that I've seen.
Well, hopefully, someone will pick up on your master's degree research and come up with a way of adding sim stuff in between keyframing that allows us to cross that last stretch. But it's been terrific talking to you today. Thank you so much. Congratulations to you and the entire team on the film.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Bill and Mike, for that. So as I said at the beginning of this podcast, this interview was recorded before the news of the $20 million loan by three studios to R&H broke. This was obviously quite the hot topic at the VES Awards, and VES Executive Director Eric Roth pointed out in his opening remarks that Rhythm & Hues has an amazing reputation for taking care of their artists. And as well, outsourcing is such a requirement for getting work done. And R&H basically did that best in class. They started out 10 years ago, more than that. They built it from scratch. They treated it like any other facility, not an outsource. And yet, here we are, a company in that situation, and the company most likely to win the visual effects Oscar, is in serious financial trouble. Meanwhile, DreamWorks Animation is changing schedule and laying off a lot of people. I'm honestly going to stop right there because there's so much bad news out there right now. and there's so many rumors flying in the visual effects space that I don't want to go any further. Look, I don't have any answers except to say that my personal opinion is that everything we're doing right now on the business side is totally proven not to work. Eric Roth mentioned we need a new business model in his talk at VES Awards and asked for suggestions. Again, my personal opinion, solidarity. Artists need to be bonded together. Facilities need to be bonded together. Strength and combined power. We've reached a point where going it alone is not the answer. It's proven. Discussion done. Okay, I have to stop because I could go on for days, and this is my personal opinion. I really hope the best for all visual effects artists all over the world. We all share the love of making and seeing beautiful, inspired films like Life of Pi and so many of the other nominated films this year, and these films make box office magic. Are you an FX Insider? FX Insider is our membership program that offers access to exclusive content and expanded articles. It's a way for people who care about visual effects and the work we do here at FX Guide to help us continue and grow. Details are at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. You've been listening to the FX Podcast. We also produce two other audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects in current releases as well as classic films. The RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. And we also produce a high-definition video podcast, FX Guide TV. You can find all of these along with in-depth articles, news, and more at fxguide.com. And also, don't forget to check out our sister site, fxphd.com, that offers extensive online visual effects training. So that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, I'm Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.